We could go lots of different places in our Bible to just kind of reflect on what's happening here today. Certainly every service that we have finds its origins in the events of this day, the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the grave. But we've chosen our text today in the book of John. It's the Gospel of John, chapter 20. So if you want to turn there, you can with me. It'll show up on the screens. The weekend started on Friday, and Jesus was unjustly accused, went through 5 mock trials, was beaten, had his beard yanked out, a crown of thorns placed on his head. It all culminated in his being nailed to a cross. And there on Friday, he said these words, "It is finished." And he died. And it tells us at the end of John 19, before we get to chapter 20, that in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had been laid. Maybe you walked into the foyer today and you saw the gardens. We've been talking about them over the last couple weeks. Gardens kind of frame our Bibles for us. In the first part of the book, there's the Garden of Eden. I'll be talking about that one. At the very end, we find out about a garden that's in heaven. And for those who have faith in Jesus Christ, it awaits us. And I can't wait to get there. I don't know about you. But in between, there's these gardens that kind of bookend this weekend. In Gethsemane, Jesus is arrested. It starts there, and we talked about that at the Good Friday service. But now we come to this garden of gardens, this garden where Jesus walks out of the grave. It starts like this here in verse 1 as we detail the happenings on that morning. On the first day of the week, a lady named Mary, she was from a place called Magdala. It's just north of Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. Been there, pretty cool. They've got a McDonald's now. I don't think they had it back then. Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early. How early? Probably between 3 and 6 a.m. And it was still dark, obviously, at that time. And saw that the stone, the way they would cover over the tombs in those days, they would have this big, huge, round rock. It would be easily rolled down. It was on kind of an incline, okay? So if you wanted to cover over the opening of your tomb, that was just a push. But if you wanted to open it, lots of guys had to get together and roll that rock back up the hill. When she got to the tomb that Jesus had been placed in, she noticed that it was empty. You heard at the beginning of our service, there was other women there. John doesn't mention those other women. The other Gospels do. What we have here is John's account. He basically just goes with what Mary experienced. It's like she had a GoPro camera on her forehead. And that's the only version of this story that we're getting, is the through the eyes of Mary. And so verse 2 says that she ran, and certainly she was joined by these other women, and they went to where the disciples were, Simon Peter, and specifically another disciple unnamed, the one whom Jesus loved. We know from the Gospel of John that this is almost indubitably, ooh, that's a good word, John himself. He referred to himself as the disciple that Jesus loved. And so Peter and John listened to the story of Mary. She says to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we," her and the other ladies, "do not know where they have laid him." And we don't have time to go through all the next verses, but let me summarize for you. Peter and John say, "Cool," and they go right back to bed. Is that what they did? No, that's not at all what they did. If you're unfamiliar with the story, the news of this, Jesus not being in his tomb, is an alarm to these two men, and they take off running in the direction of where he laid. John's younger. He's known as the youngest disciple. It could have been a teenager. Peter. And so John got there first. I don't know if you were picking up what I was putting down there, but he was an old guy and not as fast. So he comes later. John gets there first. He peeks in, the Bible tells us. He doesn't go all the way in, but Peter, when he finally gets there, huffing and puffing, blows past John. This was Peter's MO. He was a act first, think later guy, and he just busts right into this tomb. He goes in and he sees lying on this slab where the body of Jesus had been laid, the burial clothes. Now, back in those days, you would prepare a body by basically putting the legs together and just wrapping it from foot up to chest, and you would leave the top part of the body for the people who would be coming by in the tomb to pay their respects. You could still see the face of the deceased. They would put a shroud or a cloth over the face if that was too unsettling for someone. But they left the top part open. But this wrapping that had been around Jesus just laid in perfect form where he had gotten up. The Bible tells us that the shroud or the face covering was there as well. It says, and there's so much to say about this, if I had 3 Easter services, I'd preach this whole thing to you, but it says that John believed. And most scholars agree that John was the first one to pick up what Jesus had been putting down. Because up to this point, we're all looking at it back, you know, 2,000 years ago. All these followers of Jesus still weren't fully aware of what he had told them, that he would go to Jerusalem, that he would die, and in 3 days he would pick himself back up. He would come out of the grave. That didn't happen. John was the first to say, I understand what Jesus was talking about now. Most scholars think that he looked at the wrappings, which, first of all, Mary thought that the grave of Jesus had been robbed, that someone had like stolen the body. If you're going to rob a carcass, do you take the time to unwrap it? First of all, no. And then secondly, gross, right? Obviously the robbers wouldn't have done that. And if they had done it, it wouldn't be lying there as if someone had just kind of mysteriously gotten out of it. It would be all crumpled on the floor like your kids' bedrooms right now, right? But that hadn't happened. John believed. But he and Peter left, and chivalry's dead. They just left Mary back there. And the story resumes with her in verse 11. Before I get to verse 11, though, let me just kind of pause here in our proceedings to give my official welcome to everybody who hasn't been to church ever, and maybe this is your one time a year. And some churches get all fussed out about that, and they get all like, tisk, tisk, you should be here all the time. And parts of that are, I believe, true. But I'm just so glad that you're here. Welcome. Thanks for hanging out. And are you clapping for yourselves right now? Yeah, you're right. Dang tootin'. You should be glad I'm here, right? I was told I wasn't going to get any ham unless I came, so all right. No, truly, I'm glad you're here. And maybe you've come in past years, and I'm glad you're here for those things, and I hope you hear me as I speak to you today in ways that, you know, you really kind of move forward in the you know, quest or the understanding of who Jesus really is. Because here's what happens. If you only, like if you're reading a book, do you just pop to the end and read the last chapter? Most of us start at the beginning, right? If you go to a movie, do you wait till, you know, the 20 minutes are left, and then you just kind of come in and see the big fight scene, and oh, that was a great movie. No, you watch the whole thing, right? You read the whole book. And a lot of times when you come to church just every once in a while, you're hearing things that are predicated on something that happened previously. So maybe you know the story of Jesus and his resurrection, but maybe you don't understand fully, at least, why it had to happen. And that's why we built this big shower curtain back here. Here we go. I'm going to try to summarize the Bible for you up until the resurrection of Jesus Christ in 4 minutes. Here it comes. It says at the front of your books that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, God created the heavens and the earth from what? Nothing. Everything was dark and null and void. But then the Bible tells us in chapter 1 of Genesis that God started creating. And the first day, what did he say? Anybody remember? Let there be. And there was light, and that was the first day. And he said, good. And on the second day, does anybody remember what happened then? He said, let the seas be separated from the skies on the third day. That was the second day. On the third day, he says, let the land come up from the seas. That was the third day. On the fourth day, he says, let the planets, the sun and the moon and the stars exist above this earth. And on the fifth day, it says that he created the creatures that crawl, or excuse me, that swim and fly. Everything in the sea and everything in the air. And on the sixth day, he creates the land animals, and this is a hard part, pardon me, excuse me. He creates the land animals, and who else? Us. And at the end of the first 5 days, you may remember what God said? This is good. But at the end of the sixth day, do you remember what he said? In the Hebrew, it's like, this is excellent. It's very good. And it was. It was perfect. Everything was filled and functioning and right. And it only took us 2 chapters to mess it up. Because then the Bible tells us that these two humans, Adam and Eve, created for God and by God, decided not God. And they went against this one standard that he had for them. And when they did this, the Bible tells us that everything that God had created for good was now marred and ruined and marked. And even though it continued to exist, it was broken. And everything that was before, that dark and null, was kind of back, especially in a spiritual sense. It was back, and it was ours because of the sin choice that the first humans made. So there it was. That's the opening scene that precedes the one that we're talking about today. Sin left a mark on us. It separated us from the God who loves us, and something had to be done. so that it could be erased and we could be restored. And that's why we're hanging out. In the first garden, everything went wrong. Everything went wrong in that first garden. But in the garden that we remember today, Jesus put things right in that garden that we celebrate. Everything's okay. Why? Because Jesus made it so. Now, if I can do this in the rest of our time, I'm just going to kind of play off of those two gardens, Eden and this one that we're talking about today. Couple things that we need to note from both that will kind of help us understand this story even better. So starting with the first garden, the Bible tells us there was an angel in that garden that stood between the woman in that garden, this lady Eve, and God in his presence. And they were cast from him as this garden was guarded by the angel. Look what it says in Genesis chapter 3, verse 24. It says that he, God, drove out the man and the woman. And by the way, fellas, we're going to talk about the ladies in here because that's the parallel that John chooses to use. But we're just as guilty as her. Everybody gets that, right? Don't be elbowing your wife. Yeah, it's your fault. All right. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed, the Bible says, the cherubim. It's a Hebrew word that basically means angel, and a special angel, but a cherubim. And that the cherubim had a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way of the tree of life. Now, we could talk a lot about this. Don't have time. Here's in essence what's happening. Garden's closed. Humans are out. And there's something, in this case, the world's first bouncer that stands between the humans and a holy God. He's there because the humans have brought sin into the world, and there's now this divide. I was hanging out with my wife. She's the director at a place called Echo, and they had a fundraising breakfast on Wednesday. I was given a job. I was to make sure that all of the table leads, there's like 40 of them, got this little packet and knew what they had to say as table leaders. So I stood by the entrance. There was one door open to get into this banquet hall. But my job quickly generated to something a little bit more. I became the bouncer. You're supposed to have your little name badges on. And if you don't, you're supposed to go back to the table. And I don't know if I was supposed to do this, but I did it. It might not surprise you, it was only men who would try to sneak in without their badges. And all these guys would try to walk in, and I'd be like, "Excuse me, sir, did you not see the registration table right over here?" They would appreciate you getting your name badge before you come in. That was my role. No one was harmed in the experience of Wednesday morning. But this was the role of the angel, bouncer. Keep them out. Why? Because the divide exists. Now, even though God loves us still, there's something that keeps us from him. That's that garden, Eden. Everything moved from life to death and division. But in the garden that we celebrate today, the garden that Jesus rose from, there was additional angels that keep showing up at these high moments in the Bible. But these angels directed the woman that was in that garden, a lady named Mary, not away from God, barring her from him, but towards the Son of God, the only one that could solve her problem and meet her needs. It says that Mary in John chapter 20, verse 11, was weeping outside the tomb. This is a Greek word, klairo. Everybody say klairo. Yeah, nice Greek. Anyway, klairo is this word that basically means weeping uncontrollably, as in mourning the loss of a loved one. Perhaps you've seen, you know, some newsreels of people who have gone through loss in the Middle East. Even today, there will be women just weeping and rending their clothes in the streets as they cry out in anguish over the loss that they've experienced. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking a couple tears and a few sniffles. Mary is going for it. Thinks that she's alone as she cries here in the garden as she stands by this empty tomb. She's weeping outside the tomb, and as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. The tomb was a low door, and she kind of had to do this to just figure out what the disciples who had left had seen. And when she does that, she looks in, and apparently, after the disciples had gone in and left, these two angels appear to speak with Mary. There's two of them. They sit on where Jesus had laid, and they sit at the head and at the foot of Jesus. We don't know exactly why there's two. Some think it might have something to do with, like, the Ark of the Covenant. Anybody seen Indiana Jones, right? That box had two angels on its ends, and maybe it's like this symbol of glory and honor and power tied to that. But whatever the case may be, there's two of them, and one of them speaks. Those two angels were sitting there, and the one who speaks says, "Woman, why are you weeping?" Just like a man, right? What's your problem, right? What's so bad that you're freaking out? I don't know if he said it that way, but he certainly does ask, why the tears? What's going on? Now, anybody ever been in a conversation where the person that you're with knows more about what's going on than you do? You're reacting in a way that you find completely appropriate. But because they know what's really going on, they're not acting that way at all. And you can't understand why they're not crying too. That's what's happening. The angels know what's going on. I'm guessing they sat front row as Jesus rose from his grave. They're like, "That was awesome. Why are you crying? This was the best thing ever." But Mary doesn't understand. She turns to them and she says, "They have taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they have laid him." Now, this next part is kind of cool. It says in verse 14, having said this, she turned around. And when she did, she saw Jesus standing there. And she still did not know that it was Jesus who she was seeing. Now, a lot of the Bible kind of leaves things out in the details and in the writing. We just kind of assume things or guess how things might have occurred. And we got to be careful. We can't write things in that aren't there. Everybody be careful with that, okay? But what a lot of the smart guys who write the books I read wonder aloud if Mary turning to see someone behind her might not have been because one of the angels who had asked her why she was weeping did what you and I would do if someone else was not in the know and we knew that someone was behind them. Perhaps the angel went like, and this is what precipitated the turning of Mary to see Jesus. It certainly wouldn't be, a huge deviation from what angels do throughout the Bible. They have different functions, like in the garden, they're protectors, and certainly they minister in different ways. But almost always, angel—the Greek word for angel means messenger—and almost always, angels are showing up in the story of our scriptures to point people to what's going on, what God is doing. Like if you come at Christmas, you'll hear me talk about the angels who come at, you know, and see the shepherds, and they say, "Hey, man, go and see where the Son of God has been laid. He's born in Bethlehem in a manger. You can check them out." And they point the direction and the shepherds go. Anybody remember that one? That's what angels do. They point. So even though it doesn't say it specifically, perhaps the angels, like so many angels before them, were pointing. And Mary looked right in the face of Jesus. Don't miss this. And knew him not. Good Friday service ended on Friday. That's when we had it. And I was sitting right down there, and a young man comes up as everybody's leaving in silence and just stands there. And I don't know who he is. And then my wife, Eleanor, is sitting next to me, and she pops up and yells, "Caleb, my son Cooper went to middle school with Caleb, who is a full-grown man now." And I'd seen him, you know, but not recently. And this happens too often here. I know you, but I don't really know you. Has anybody got that in your life? I'm looking right at you. I know I should know you, but I don't know who you are. I know I'm preaching, and you're just trying to get through this, some of you, but listen to me. So many people over the last couple thousand years have looked straight in the face of Jesus, heard his story, been told what he's about, and never saw him. Why? Because they went to some college where they had a smart professor who explained why he's stupid and not to believe in him. Or you just surfed YouTube and saw all the clips from, you know, Hutchins and Gervais and whoever else and denies his existence. And you come to a service like this, you sing his songs, a guy in an uncomfortable suit gets up and preaches at you. And you hear about him, but you, even as you look straight at him, you don't see him. And so, put me in the long line of messengers who have told you about Jesus. I pray today's the day that you see him. And because initially Mary didn't. In the first garden, God asked the woman what she'd done. This is great. If you go back to Genesis 3, Eve having blown it and Adam having blown it with her, tries to hide herself. She sews with Adam these fig aprons to try to cover up their shame. And then when God comes into the garden, it tells us in Genesis 3 that she what? She and Adam try to hide. like that's a thing, right? From a holy God who's already seen everything and knows everything. She tries to hide, and God calls her out, starts with Adam and asks him what he did. He blames his wife, and so he turns to the woman in verse 13. First time that ever happened, fellas, but he blames the woman, and then God gets to Eve, who still doesn't have her name yet. She's just the woman. And he says to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" And the woman took a play out of Adam's playbook. She blames the serpent. But then, just like her husband, she finally gets around to admitting, "Yeah, the one thing you told us not to do, I did that." Now, when God comes to that garden, it's not like the one that we're talking about today. God's not coming to make everything better. People don't like this side of God, but he's just, he's righteous. He's right and correcting. And so when he comes into the garden, he says, "Hey man, I told you not to do this." So there has to be a price that's paid. And he doles out the consequences. He starts with the snake, he moves on to the woman, he finishes with the man. Numbered amongst those consequences are pain, relational strife and division, toil and suffering where once there was none. And then the big clincher is death. The two people who would have never died because sin comes in, death comes in with it. These are the things that are the product of the first garden. The question that God asks is, "What have you done?" But in this garden that we talk about today, come on, let's get to some good news. Anybody like good news? In the garden that we're talking about today, God's Son appears in his resurrected form, and he talks to this first woman, Mary, and asks her this question: "Whom do you seek?" It's different. He's going in a different direction. This is the first interaction. Don't miss this. This is the first time that the resurrected Jesus speaks to another human being. He chooses Mary. We'll get to why that's so puzzling in a second. But he could have gone to anybody. Like, he could have shown up when Peter and John. There we go. When Peter and John had showed up, he could have popped out then. "Hey, fellas." And that would have made sense, right? He hung out with these guys for like 3.5 years, shared with them in ministry, went through thick and thin. Of course he's going to go to his bros first, right? He's eventually going to get there. He's going to show up later that night and surprise them in a room. Read that. That's a good story. But he doesn't go to them first. If I were Jesus, I'd go talk to Pilate. Some of you don't know, like an airline pilot? No, there's this guy, Pilate, who was the Roman governor, who was basically complicit in this mock trial of Jesus and just washes his hand and hands him over to the mob to be killed. If not Pilate, I would have gone to the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees who are a part of the, the cancel culture that wanted Jesus dead or whatever, right? I would have been like, "I'm back, hey." And then because I was God's son, I'd wipe them all out. Anybody with me who'd do that? Anybody? I'd take them to the woodshed. That's why we're all glad I'm not the Son of God. Jesus chooses something different. He chooses to appear to Mary. Now, ladies, I don't mean to offend you, but 2,000 years ago, it was even worse. Women in this culture were completely overlooked. Couldn't be trusted, certainly wouldn't be given positions of esteem. So he comes to a woman. Don't forget, the first garden, sin came into the world through the woman. The man was complicit, but it came. So John's kind of being like, "Hey, don't miss this. The gardens converge." He comes to a woman, and he comes to a woman who is messed up. Mark chapter 16, verse 9. Has this one itty-bitty verse about this whole day, basically. It says this: "Now when he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene," and then that's how we know who he talked to first. And then it says this: "Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out previously in their lives together 7 demons. It says this again in the book of Luke. I looked it up. I was like, wow, is this like a real thing? Yeah, this Mary of Magdalene was oppressed, possessed by the enemy of God. Historically, she's, this is kind of, just folklore, but like she's associated with sex work. She was like just, like the least of the least of the least of these. Remember when Jesus said, if you don't welcome the least of these, you can have no part of me? Jesus went to the very end of the least list. And he says, that's who I'm going to show up to first. Now, look at me. Let that be an encouragement to everybody in here who thinks, yeah, you don't know me, Mark. I've done way too much. God could never accept me. I can't believe this building is still standing. I walked in today and it didn't fall down. Listen to me. Our Savior, Jesus, is in the business of redeeming the least of the least of the least of these. That's where he started. It's where he continues in life. He took this guy. You don't know me, but that's pretty amazing. And he took a lot of the people that I'm looking at and share church with, and I do know them, and I will tell you, it is amazing that he's taken any of us, but he starts with Mary. He says this to the woman. He says, why are you weeping? Great, another insensitive man. Started with the angels, and now this guy is asking the same question. What's your problem? Again, he knows what's really going on. But he doesn't stop there. He says, whom are you seeking? Who are you looking for? Now, John's gospel is a little different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the other three gospels. John writes in a more theological way, metaphorical way. He kind of tells the story behind the story. And even as he starts this one, he emphasizes the darkness of the day, which is kind of spiritually where Mary and everybody else in the world was existing, in the dark. And he comes to Mary, and sure, he knows that Mary is specifically looking for Jesus who had died. His body is gone. He knows that. But he asked this broader question. He's like, hey, Mary, just curious, who are you seeking? If you take that and kind of impute it into the other garden, in Garden of Eden, Eve, the first woman, who was she seeking? Well, ultimately, it turned out to be herself. Why? Because why did she take of the fruit that she was forbidden? It was going to make her better and add to her bottom line. And so it was the first time, of which has been, you know, just the human experience, that a human thought, you know what, I'm God, and I'm going to do what I want, regardless of whether the God who created me said to or not. And so Eve sought herself, just like the rest of us have always been plagued with this urge, this desire, this innate nature to seek self over God. But now in this garden, Jesus kind of says, hey, man, who are you seeking? Mary, who do you seek? We're going to see that she chooses to seek and follow him, the Son of God, and it's going to make all the difference in her life. Supposing him to be the gardener, that verse finishes. I love that. Everybody knows that the first gardener in all of history, a guy named Adam, he was put in the Garden of Eden to tend and to you know, keep. Paul, the writer of the letter to the 1 Corinthians, refers to Jesus as the second Adam. So we got this other interplay between the gardeners. Jesus was confused with the gardener. And she says to Jesus, who she still doesn't recognize, sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I'll take him away. Just let me know where he is. I'm over here bawling my eyes out, losing my mind. I watched him die. I came to pay my respects, and he's not here. Just let me know where I can find the body of the one that I followed and loved. And he says, I'll take care of him. And then we get to the whole thing I wanted to say to you today. In this garden, God's Son calls the woman by her name. Look what happens next. Jesus, hearing this, you know, request for Mary, just skips to the point. He looks at her. I picture him kind of lining her up, you know, and maybe through her tears, she's finally starting to focus. The sun is just kind of coming up, right? And maybe she's able to see a little bit better, but he lines her up and she just says, Mary. Now, it says Mary in our English translations, but the actual Greek word is Miriam, which is another kind of, you know, subname, other name for Mary. But all through the telling of this story, John is careful to reference Mary as Maria, which is the proper Greek form of Mary. But here, Jesus doesn't say Maria. He says something that would immediately let Mary know that he knew her. Calls her by her pet name. Anybody got pet names for your kids? when their friends hear you call them their pet names, or they're like, whoa, what's up? Whatever your pet name is, right? Yeah? This is kind of what happens. Jesus looks into the face of his friend and he says, Miriam. And an incredible thing happens. She's going to recognize the one that she didn't recognize, all because he said her name. You know, the Bible talks a lot about how Jesus calls us by name. Did you know that? Like, if you're a Christian right now, you might think that you got smart enough to figure it out and to make the decision. And no, that was part of it. Certainly, our will has to mend or meld with God's. But we are called, the Bible tells us, by our shepherd as his sheep. Look what Jesus taught a little bit later in the book of John. In John chapter 10, he calls himself the good shepherd. He says, the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And then he said earlier in that same teaching, he says, the sheep hear the good shepherd's voice. And he calls out his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he has brought all his own, he goes before them and the sheep follow him. For they, one more time, know his voice. Yeah, Christians are Christians because Christ called them into life with him. They heard his voice. And hearing his voice, they looked past what they thought they saw, and they saw him for real. And they received what only he can give. And in doing so, by faith, they were forgiven of their sins. He calls her name, and immediately she understands what's going on. He says, Mary, and she turned and said to him in Aramaic, it's kind of the common language, the street language of that time, Rabboni, which he clarifies for his Greek readers who didn't understand Aramaic. It means teacher. In the Hebrew, word for teacher is rabbi, but Rabboni is this more intimate form of rabbi, kind of like Miriam's a more intimate form of Mary. They make this connection. They understand who each other are. And it says there in verse 17, get this. It says in verse 17 that Mary was told by Jesus, do not cling to me. So, for our purposes, here's what's just happened. Jesus reveals himself to Mary. First time he's ever done it in his post-resurrected form. Mary hears and sees Jesus for real. And what basically happens there is we have our first post-resurrection conversion of anybody who has put their faith in Jesus Christ. What Mary does is kind of symbolic. It doesn't say it there, but Jesus tells her not to do it, so we know she's doing it. What does he say? Quit hugging me. Let go. Anybody ever been in that hug that was too long? This was one of those. Let go of me. He tells her, you know, in the rest of that verse, I'm not leaving yet. I'm going to ascend later at another time. We'll see each other again. Go tell my friends what you've seen. And that's what in verse 18 she does. She goes and lets everybody know, this is what I saw. I saw him. He called my name. He's alive. What I picture there is Mary grabbing on to Jesus. It's what anybody would do if you had you were able to see someone you didn't expect to see for a long time or ever again. If you loved that person, you would just throw your arms around him and not want to let go. I picture her grabbing his garment and just hanging on to his robe. Kind of reminds me of another story in the Gospels. There's a woman who needs healing. She can't get to Jesus. There's too big of a crowd. She just decides, if I can just touch his robe, I'll be healed just by touching what he's wearing. And in Luke 8, it tells us that she does that. She's somehow able to reach through the crowd and grab on to her king. And it tells us that Jesus says, hey, who touched me? And he turns around and she says, it's me. And what does he say? It's your faith that has made you well. I don't know where you are in this whole Jesus thing. For some of you, that's exactly what it is. It's a Jesus thing. You're here under duress. You're here because you have to. Perhaps I haven't said enough to compel you, but here's basically what every messenger who's pointing you to Jesus is trying to do. Is they're trying to ask you, which garden are you in? Because you have the choice. You notice I didn't pull the curtain all the way. It's not pulled all the way yet. That's coming when Jesus comes back. It's going to be perfect again. Are you with me? But right now we live in the time that's in between. And we have the choice in which garden we stay in. For a lot of people, they're still in Eden. And until they put their faith in Jesus Christ, they can't join him in the garden of his resurrection. So my question to you is, which garden are you in? If you're in Eden, in the first garden, sin stands between you and God, just like that angel stood between the first people and him. But if you have by faith received what Jesus willingly gives by dying and rising again, you can be in this garden where Jesus stands, not to judge, but to call your name. If you're in Eden, if you're in this first garden, you're there and it's all about the mess that the first people made, that you and I continue to make as we continue to sin and separate ourselves from God. But if you, by grace, have understood and believed by faith that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and that he has died and rose again so that you might be forgiven of your sins, you can be in this garden, which isn't about the mistakes we made. It's about the price that he paid. I got up really early this morning, kind of like Mary. And I drove up here and I listened to the song that we're about to sing. The name of it's Gratitude. And I got to Mission Barbecue. And my eyes just opened up in tears. Because, yeah, it's my job. I need to come and preach a good message. But I was overwhelmed by the truth, not only that I get to share with you guys, but that I get to live in myself. I am saved miraculously by the grace of a loving God. He sent his son Jesus to die for me and for you. He called my name Mark, and he pulled me out of Eden and into the garden where he was resurrected from his grave. I'm so grateful for that. And all of us can experience that and receive that if only we by faith would choose him. I pray you're grateful. Sing your gratitude to him.